Petzl headlamps. Not a headlamp.
They're a torch, Don.
You know, if you put a lamp on your head and you ran around, people would start to talk.
But if you have a torch, they're just going to run behind you.
That's right, because you'll lead the way.
Leading the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Petzl does. They lead the way in head torches.
Reactive lighting, rechargeable, the whole thing. And the strap that goes on the head, so easy to adjust. There were times...
Even Don can do it.
There were times, Scott, I'm going to have to turn my man card in and say, Scott, could you please tighten this up for me? Because I just don't have that skill set. But the new type that Petzl has, super easy and effective.
You know, I typically go to the Tika RXP because it's a lighter one. It's not as heavy as the Now. But I pulled out the Now the other day. That sure is a nice head torch.
It's not that heavy, Scott.
It's not. And it's... freaking bright.
It's bright.
And its battery lasts a little bit longer than that Tika RXP.
If you've ever run at night and you've run through the day and into the night, you know how much work it is to try to concentrate. And when you have enough light on the trail, it's a lot easier.
I was having a conversation with a fellow friend of mine. He's not a fellow friend. He's just a friend.
What is? Let me Google fellow friend. What is a fellow friend?
But he was in the market for a headlamp, and
for his head, Scott?
I think he went to REI and he saw some real expensive ones, and he said, "You know what? I'm just going to get this $25 headlamp."
Big mistake.
And then I showed him what a Petzl Now is, and he said, "Really? Is it worth that much more?" And I go, every single penny. You're going to spend more money on batteries for that stinking little headlamp.
You're right.
Over the course of the life of that headlamp, why not invest in a Petzl Now or a Petzl Tika RXP? It's going to pay. The ROI on it is crazy.
Some business talk. You know, you spend money on shoes. You spend money on a lot of things. In fact, you spend a lot of money just driving up to the trailhead. Make sure you put yourself in the right gear. And do you know what it costs for a fractured wrist or a twisted ankle or a busted tooth?
A lot.
That's what happens when you can't see what you're doing.
Yep. And it scares off the bears. Go to Petzl.com.
Ultra Running Magazine, probably my favorite printed journal.
It is awesome, and I smile every time I go to the mailbox and pull it out because it is it is probably the only magazine that I subscribe to that I read it cover to cover. It's that good.
I don't know what kind of power that Carl and Erica have over there with the ultra running community, but they have the coolest and best contributing authors anywhere.
It's because they are members and leaders of the ultra running mafia.
There's a mafia?
They threaten and they extort to get the very best writers to write for their magazine.
Well,
and it's always improving. There's all sorts of new writers that are coming on board. Ann Trason is on monthly now where you can ask her questions.
Ask Ann, yeah.
You know, Corey Reese, we've talked about him, and he, I'll tell you what, he's a fun guy to read.
So 2016, get yourself a year subscription for only $29.95.
Go to our partners page. There's a link there. You can link over, and you will get your discount, and you can begin a life of better performance.
Go to the partners page, link over, and bam, you're there.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's,
I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr, and today we have Sage Cannaday. And if you have been out running trails and accidentally got stuck underneath a rock and you don't know who Sage Cannaday is, let me tell you about Sage.
Tell us about Sage, Scott.
You know, the first thing I did was I go to Ultra Sign Up.
As you should.
And I was looking at the 22 finishes that are recorded on Ultra Sign Up, and he podiumed 20 of the 22 races that he participated in.
Wow.
That's recorded on Ultra Sign Up.
Yeah, that's impressive.
You know, he is, as I was looking through some of his bio stuff and doing some research, Sage has excelled at pretty much every distance. Is that correct, Sage?
you're
supposed to say
that.
Yes. You're supposed to say yes.
I haven't finished my 100 miler, so I can't say that yet.
You will, and I'm afraid when you do, it's going to be screaming fast.
It'll be on the podium because that's a trend.
It will be. He's just to give you an idea of how fast this guy is. He's a 2:16 and some change marathoner. Done a lot of 50 milers. In fact, I think I read somewhere that's your preferred distance. Is that correct?
No, I do like it. It's a fun distance to do on trails, but it really depends on the course. I also like really technical mountainous 50Ks, and
okay.
I'm hoping I like 100 miles. I don't know yet. still open for new experiences at different distances.
What distance do you think you're the best at?
I mean, it's not so much the distance as I'd say like the duration of the race and the nature of the vertical profile of the race. So I like long climbs. I like the Speed Goat 50K is a good climbing race. I like climbable, runnable climbs anywhere in the 50K to hopefully 100 mile range.
Which really explains, which really explains his 4:17 mile pace. There's no climbs on that.
Well, and it also really describes why he lives at the foothills of the Flatiron Mountains in Boulder, Colorado, because I've run some of those mountains, and there isn't a whole lot of downhill, except on your return, of course. Mm-hmm. But the reason we got Sage on here, if you can remember back, we've been talking about recently, and actually for years, you know, we've had Dr. Phil Maffetone on a bunch of times and talking about fat adaption and trying to become a fat burning machine and kind of changing your diet or experimenting with your diet and going a little bit lower on the carbohydrates. And especially recently, we've really got on with low carbohydrates. And we had one of our nation members, Taylor, and I'm going to hopefully I say his last name right, Taylor Maltz, reached out to us and said, hey, you know, there's another side to the story here. And he recommended a few sources of other athletes that have been successful with not necessarily a low-carb diet. And the list was fairly lengthy, but we caught Sage's name, and we thought, you know what? We've never had Sage on the podcast. This sounds like a great opportunity to get Sage on. And the experiment of one that he has shows that his diet absolutely worked for him. So we want to just talk to Sage a little bit. So we haven't let Sage talk a whole lot. Sage, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm honored to be on the show. This will be fun.
So what kind of, and I want to use the word diet term loosely. You know, we've had Matt Fitzgerald on who wrote the book Diet Cults and kind of talked about that. But so I want to use that term loosely. But what kind of diet do you prescribe for yourself?
Yeah, I don't like the word diet. I like the word lifestyle.
There you go. That's
I
a better word.
If you had to categorize it, it would be a whole foods, plant-based lifestyle, which if you follow basically eating a lot of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, which kind of inherently is a high-carb, low-fat, relatively low-protein type of diet, kind of the Ornish, Dr. Ornish diet, the 80-10-10, so to speak. I think I'm probably more like 75% carbs, but it depends on the day. But I like the term lifestyle because diet kind of has a restrictive connotation to it. Lifestyle is more about embracing kind of a holistic approach, I think, to your health and combining what you eat with how you run and how you train. So, yeah, if you had to categorize me in a type of label, I guess it would be the whole foods plant-based diet.
And I think that you've been very outspoken about how your lifestyle food intake has really attributed to your not only success as a winning athlete, but also a thing that's kind of crazy is you've been running for years and years and years, and you haven't had a whole lot of overuse injury. And I think part of that is, absolutely because of the way you train, but I think you attribute a lot of that to the way that you eat also.
Yeah, no, for sure. Diet, I think, besides your actual, like, the amount of time you sleep each day and maybe work stress, other stresses in your life, the actual training you do, the next most important thing for your performance as an athlete, endurance athlete, would be what you eat. And, you know, I'm not the only one. There's tons of other vegetarian ultra runners out there. Ellie Greenwood, Ashley Erba, Lizzie Hawker, Rob Krar. I know he eats some fish sometimes, but he's mostly vegetarian. Darcy Africa, Liza LaPierre, all vegetarian athletes do really well. And even, you know, looking at people like Max King or Stephanie Howe, they're not vegetarian, but they're definitely high carb, from what I've seen at least. So I wouldn't say like I'm too much in the minority, at least from some of the people I know.
So let's talk about protein intake, at least before we get into any of the fat stuff. As a vegetarian, how hard do you work at counting protein or filling your plate with amino acids you need to repair that body of yours that you're out there, you know, hammering the hills with?
Yeah, so, you know, protein, I'm actually not too worried about it. Mm. I know it's essential. You need essential amino acids. Your body needs that to regenerate muscle and to repair itself and to grow. But I think, you know, the general rule of thumb is people look at protein guidelines. Most Americans get way more than enough protein than they need. And it's surprising how many things, you know, if you eat amino acids in beans and rice, for example, you don't even have to eat them at the same time. The amino acids are stored and pooled in your body and could be combined later as complementary amino acids. So you don't always have to be filling your plate with a bunch of protein, even from plant sources. And I think, you know, 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight is definitely plenty of protein. I don't count what I get. I know it's a relatively low percent compared to my percentage of carbohydrate intake, but it's, you know, it's probably 15% type of range, I'd say 10 to 15%.
So let's break that down. What is your percentage of carbohydrates, fat, and protein in your diet, in your lifestyle of eating, as Scott phrased it?
It depends on the day. Again, it's like about like the Ornish diet, 80-10-10. Okay. Some days it could be 70-15-15. It depends if I eat a lot of avocados or nuts. that would boost my fat proportion up. Depends if I eat a whole block of tofu or something, or a whole bunch of beans and rice. So, you know, it varies. I'm not real strict on the exact ratio.
So we think about carbohydrates. Maybe we should delineate between refined sugars and packaged processed carbohydrates versus the type of carbohydrates you're talking about of whole food elements. Let's kind of break that down a bit.
How do you define the carbohydrates you eat?
Yeah, so definitely not all carbs are created equal. And definitely with the whole foods plant-based diet that Dr. Esselstein and Dr. Colin T. Campbell always preach, the whole foods component comes into that. So you could eat a lot of whole grain rice. You eat a lot of whole oats. You're getting a lot of carbohydrates from fruits and vegetables. Yams, for example, a lot of fruit is very high in sugar, but it's a natural sugar. It's not refined. Because obviously, you know, any processed food, any highly refined food, that source of carbohydrates is not going to be as good for you. That's kind of that's the thing. You eat whole foods. You don't need to eat packaged processed food with a bunch of preservatives, and you don't need to eat a bunch of refined sugar.
So when I go to the grocery store and buy some spaghetti pasta, What is the best type of pasta that I can buy? Is there something specific you look for when you buy pasta?
I like rice noodles more now than traditional wheat. I will eat whole wheat noodles. I make whole wheat pizza crust all the time. I like whole wheat noodles. My girlfriend Sandy's actually a lot healthier than I am, and she'll mainly eat. We eat a lot of rice noodles, brown rice noodles, for example. I don't think pasta is as bad as it's cracked up to be. I wouldn't go out of my way to eat huge, huge amounts of white flour, white pasta all the time. But I think it's, you know, it's like the typical carbo loading thing for marathon runners and ultra runners. And I think it's kind of gotten a bad rap, at least from some sides of the low carb crowd. But generally, yeah, whole wheat flour is better than just white flour. You get more fiber.
You know, let's talk about this whole carb loading thing. I remember, you know, back, I don't know, 15, 20 years, I had some friends, this is before I even thought about putting on running shoes, and I had some friends that were pretty fast marathoners, and they would always talk about the, you know, carb depletion and then the carb load right before the race. Where do you stand on that? Do you play with that at all, or do you keep your diet pretty consistent?
You know, I used to play with it a bit more, but my views have evolved over time as well. Like, I've definitely cut out dairy and eggs a lot more in the last year, gone more vegan than just ovo-lacto vegetarian. But with carbohydrates, in terms of carbo loading, you know, I'm just consistently eating a pretty high carb diet, and the body can only store so much glycogen. You know, you eat carbs, your body stores glycogen in your liver and muscles, and to utilize as fuel. And it's you're good to go on pure carbs for about 20 miles at a pretty high intensity before you have to take in either more carbs or use some other alternative fuel source. And if you look at the best distance runners in the world, hands down, the East Africans, they generally eat a very high carb diet. A lot of it's Ugali based, which is basically this like cornmeal, maize, mush, and a lot of vegetables as well. But they're getting through marathons in, you know, 2 hours, 5 minutes. They're cleaning my clock. They're finishing way ahead of me in a marathon. And I'm sure they could go much longer distances. If you see the Comrades Ultra Marathon, I mean, you'll roll through 50 miles at an extremely fast pace there with a lot of climbing. So they're very fat adapted as well, even though you're eating a pretty high carbohydrate diet. Because of the nature of your training, you're still burning a pretty high percentage of fat, and you're still able to spare glycogen pretty well. And then, you know, you take in carbs as you go along in the race, and you could perform at a really high level.
So that you nailed my next question, Sage. So what we have been taught, or the theory is we need to become a fat adapted machine or a fat adapted engine. And the way that we have talked about on the podcast before is you're not going to learn how to change your body into this fat adapted engine unless you're restricting the amount of carbohydrates that you're taking in on a daily basis. So my question for you is, and for the East Africans or for yourself, when you're eating 75 to 80% carbohydrates in your daily diet and you're going out for your morning run, how do you train your body to burn the fat as fuel rather than the carbohydrates you've been ingesting?
Yeah, so part of it is how you, if you're pushing your mileage limit in training, let's say you wake up, you don't have a huge pancake breakfast, but, you know, you have a banana and maybe a little oatmeal or something. Then you go out for a pretty long run at a moderate intensity. You're still going to be training yourself to burn a pretty decent amount of fat. You already have a lot of glycogen in your liver and muscle cells or muscles. And you have that food you just ate, but you're still going to be burning some fat. And if you're always running consistently higher mileage than you've ever done in a week, you're doing some long runs. And I'm talking about, you know, maybe you do a 20 mile long run on the weekend or something. You don't take a gel every 3 miles. You might take a gel once or twice to get through that 20 mile long run. Now, if it was a marathon race, I'd take 3 to 5 gels probably in it. Cause I'm performing all out race, high intensity. And, you know, if you don't have any stomach issues, you might as well take as much fuel as possible, because it's going to allow you to really perform at a high level. And, you know, there's been some studies, more recent studies that come out. I think it was Jeff Folick and was it Finney maybe? It was a faster study. And right, it was inherently a little bit biased. All of these peer-reviewed scientific studies, actually, you look at who they're funded by and you try to find the bias. That's the first thing I do. It was funded by Atkins. and they use a lot of different types of ultra runners. I think Zach Bitter, for example, was in the study. And basically they found if you eat a, you know, a higher fat diet generally and restrict your carbohydrate intake, you burn a higher percentage of fat running at, you know, a certain intensity, aerobic threshold maybe. But just because you're burning a higher percentage of fat doesn't mean you're going to be performing better or performing up to your optimal performance at all. It means maybe you don't have to take quite as many gels. Whereas the way I see it is, you know, the furnace is hot. It'll burn if you're operating close to your maximum performance and trying to get the best out of your body. And if you just look at the basics of human physiology, the basics of the Krebs cycle, the body is very efficient at burning carbohydrates as fuel.
Hmm. And I think we go back as far back as some of our earlier podcasts with Sunny Blende, that she's talking about we can only process 200 to 300 calories per hour. And we know that it takes more than that to run through those trails out there. So all of us are fat adapted to some extent. We are running and burning fat as fuel. If we're out there anything more than that 20 miles that you're talking about, Sage, we've got to reach into our own fat stores if we're going to actually continue moving past 20, if in fact we can only digest or process 200 calories. So I think we're all on a fat adapted process as we're out there training along.
So how does the bonk figure into this whole thing? So if you're out there you're doing a 50K, and Sage, forgive me, but you've probably never been out on a 50K for 4 hours, for longer than 4 hours. But let's say you're into a 50K 4 hours, and you haven't been trickling in the gels on a regular basis. Isn't that what causes the bonk? Is your body is looking for that glycogen? You've depleted your glycogen in your cells.
Yeah, no, for sure. Actually, I have been out for 50Ks over 5 hours. The Speed Goat 50K, which I've done, very mountainous 50K.
And won. And set records.
that took me 5 hours.
Okay.
So that was a 5-hour 50K, 12,000 feet of climbing at altitude. But you would definitely. You basically go hypoglycemic, and I've actually had some of my worst bonks in road marathons, not even ultras. In ultras, you could kind of feel the bonk creeping up on you, and then you just eat more and you feel better. In road marathon, though, I went without taking gels once at too high of an intensity, and I was overtrained, but I went from running about 5-minute mile pace to actually walking, to actually worrying that I was going to fall and hit my head on the pavement because I was so dizzy. So you're going hypoglycemic. The brain has trouble operating. You get negative thought patterns. You have trouble. You get dizzy, but then your muscles are shutting down because you're really low on fuel. But it's basically when you don't pace yourself well. You push yourself too hard, too fast, too early usually, and you don't have you burn through all your glycogen. This happens really fast at altitude as well, and you're done. Whereas if you went out, I've been out on eight-hour mountain excursions at 12,000 feet doing the 10-mile traverse, it's called. And I had one gel all day, but I was going at a moderate intensity. I was going pretty easy, like 60%. So I could burn fat all day and not eat anything and not bonk. But if I'm racing really hard and I'm really pushing the envelope and trying to reach my potential, then you need to balance your carbohydrate intake or fuel intake with the work output that you're putting forth. And for example, I just raced the Black Canyon 100K about 4 weeks ago, and I was telling people, I took a gel every 20 minutes, and people were like, well, that's a lot of gels. Like, you were taking a gel every 20 minutes. Like, that's too much. If I did that, I'd have a stomach ache. And I agree. If you're running at a different pace, say, for example, I'm covering 3 miles in about 20 minutes during the race, another person maybe is not covering that much distance. It might take them 40 minutes to cover 3 miles, right? But it's the same sort of work output. So maybe they're not taking a gel every 20 minutes. They're taking a gel once every 40 minutes because that's the work output to go 3 miles. It's the same concept of why people always bonk in a marathon around mile 20. Even the fast guys running 230, 220 bonk at mile 20. And then other people that are running in the 3 to 4 hour range for a marathon, they bonk around mile 20. They're out there in the elements longer. They might suffer from the heat and dehydration and other things that could really make you feel like you're bonking as well. But it's a work output, essentially.
I think that's a good way to look at it, the work output. Mm-hmm. If you're really going to have your foot into the throttle, it's going to take some fuel in that tank to make that happen. And if you can figure out how to back off that intensity, you can go, you can coast a long time with the fat stores that you have if you're not really pushing too much. And so I think that gives a good perspective when you're out there on the trail allows you to think about manipulating your own intensity out there if you start to run into some problems. So some good rationale.
Sage, you do a lot of coaching, and we'll talk about a little bit later how somebody could hook up with you as a coach. But let's say that you have a new athlete that's coming to you, and they've either read something or listened to a podcast where they think that this low carb type of lifestyle is the right thing for them. How would you coach them?
Yeah, so our coaching business is Sage Running, sagerunning.com. And my girlfriend, Sandy Nightpaver, actually helps a lot with our coaching clients. And we don't do as much really in-depth nutritional consulting type of thing yet. But we do look at it. And obviously, as athletes that we coach, they ask us all sorts of questions mm-hmm. and fueling and things like that. But, definitely... I tell prospective athletes or people out there, like, don't believe what you read on the internet. Don't believe what anyone says, basically. There's a lot of articles on nutrition floating around. There's peer-reviewed research studies that are very biased. I admit as myself, like, I'm not a nutritionist. I'm obviously not a doctor. I'm a runner. I did take some nutrition classes in college, but... And it's like a hobby. It's a passion. We study, but I'm very biased. I'll admit to that. Like I was born and raised vegetarian. Obviously, I'm going to be really biased. Other people out there, you know, with your personal beliefs, how you were raised, where you were raised in the world, is going to influence your opinions on diet and the lens that you see these studies and this literature. Coming out there is going to, everyone's going to be biased. The researchers are biased. You try to remove the bias from scientific research, but the fact of the matter is a lot of the studies out there are funded by, in the U.S., for example, the dairy and meat industry are huge billion-dollar corporations. So I always look at, where was this research study funded from? What is this doctor selling, things like that. I'd be cautious, I guess, is what I'd say.
We have you on video Skype, and you said, obviously, I'm not a doctor, but it's not obvious. If you put a stethoscope around your neck, Sage, and maybe one of those mirrors on top of your head, I would say that you're very doctor-like.
A mirror on your head?
Some doctors have those,
a little flashlight thing. Yeah.
What are those called?
I don't know exactly what they are. But you could be a doctor. It wouldn't take much.
Well, the one thing that this goes back probably a year where we talked to Matt Fitzgerald about diet cults. And the big thing that I got out of that is each individual may try something. They've heard something or read something, and they'll try it, and it works for them. And so then they get on this soapbox and say, this is the way everybody should eat. And he said, that's a cult. You kind of have to figure things out. One thing that I watched a video recently that you did where you're talking about this, and you said, this is what has worked for you. And it obviously has worked extremely well for you. And you named off a number of very high-performing, very successful running athletes that we're all familiar with that are using the same kind of lifestyle that you are. So I think that's where I take from it is you kind of got to play with your diet and try to mix things up and see where that good zen is for you.
There's a lot.
I like steak. I just want to say I like steak.
There's a lot of variables. You can come all of a sudden change your diet, but everything else all of a sudden fit into place, like your sleep, like your stress at work and your periodization, whatever you're doing, everything kind of aligns itself, and you assume that whatever you're doing at that time must be the magic solution. So there's so many variables, which makes the sport fun. There's so many dials and levers to move.
And it changes as your body gets older too.
Oh, yeah. Body does change.
Yeah.
Sage, yeah, my metabolism slowed down over age.
You're not,
I don't eat as much as I did when I was in college, but I eat healthier now. So
I'm trying to think where I think it's on your website, sagecanada.com, where there's an article on there. I'll link it to the podcast where you compare what you used to eat in college, which was a lot of beer and pizza, I believe, and what you've kind of evolved to eating nowadays. I think that's pretty comical. I think we've all gotten there. I have a son in college right now, and he eats, I don't know how he functions with the stuff he eats. It's just amazing.
I actually probably drink more beer now than I did in college, a lot more.
Is it higher quality beer?
It's higher quality beer, but it's also just on a regular basis. You know, I'll have one Avery beer every night, whereas in college it was, you know, you'd do it sparingly, but then you'd overdo it maybe a couple times. Whereas now I'm just consistently going for the high quality taste and having a beer at dinner. So it's good. Everything in moderation.
so one a day for a month is 30 beers, and in college it was 30 beers in a night.
Hey Sage, I'm really interested and would like to get into how consistent you've been with your not only your results but your longevity and your ability to dodge the overuse injury bullet. How do you train? Do you think about that as you train, and how do you periodize your training? Tell us about the tricks.
Yeah.
What do you monitor?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Knock on wood somewhere. I don't want to get jinxed, but yeah, no, I've been really lucky over the years, because I've pretty much been training year round the last 17 years of my life. I started running in middle school and just basically never stopped. It's my main sport. I'm too uncoordinated to do any other sport. I don't ski. I don't play golf. All I do is run, even in the winter. And so I'm training a lot of years. It's 48, 50 weeks out of the year. I'm running, and almost every day. A lot of, you know, 4,000 plus mile years in there. And part of it, you know, I'll admit, I think part of it's probably I got lucky with genetics. My parents are fairly healthy. Bone density is a big one. And, you know, running mechanics, some of that's genetic, but some of it's also learned, and some of that's what you focus on. And then again, going back to diet, I think that's played a key role, just with eating a lot of antioxidants found in like plants and fruit. You could really help reduce your inflammation and inflammatory response to stress in training. And I think that's definitely helped too. So diet, and then just, yeah, trying to be patient and progress in your training kind of in a logical way where you don't change any variable too quickly. You don't, you know, if something hurts, you back off. If you're getting a little tendonitis or a little ache and pain here and there, then, you know, I'm not afraid to take a day off. And I also don't, you know, I'll have a general goal in mind maybe for the week or the month or the year in terms of training. Like I'd like to run, you know, for example, 100 miles this week. But if I only run 99 miles or 97 miles, I'm like, so what, whatever. Whereas back in college, I was a little more obsessed, and I'd go out at 11:30 at night and say, I need to get in that extra 3 miles so I could hit 100. Because 100 miles a week is so much different from 97.
Yeah, that's right. Quality miles.
So kind of letting go.
the difference between you and I, Sage, is if I need to go out on a Saturday night to get one more mile, it takes me about three times as long as it takes you. You can usually kick off that mile in sub five, maybe even close to that 4 minute mark. Or I'm out for a half hour.
So you talked about monitoring your gait. What do you have to monitor? What do you work on to keep your gait clean?
Lots of things over the years. I'm still monitoring it, still working on things. Just a lot of it, I think, comes down to stride rate with runners. And what you find with a lot of overuse injuries is people, well, they run on hard surfaces, or they try to change their form too fast. Maybe they try to force a 4 foot strike or something like that. And that could jack up your Achilles tendon or calf pretty quickly. If you add too much mountain climbing or vertical into your training, all of a sudden you could get Achilles tendonitis or something like that. So I'm always conscious of mixing flatter running days with climbing days. And focusing on the stride rate, which changes, granted, on trails and climbing. But on generally on easy days, if you're floating along at a comfortable pace, conversational pace is what we call it because you could talk, you generally want to be at least over 100 steps per minute. And that's pretty consistent with most people, I think. And if you're slower than that, it means you're probably overstriding a little bit or putting too much effort into your stride, which could lead to landing too far in front of your center of gravity, which could result in braking forces that kind of radiate up your leg, which could cause anything from problems in the feet with plantar fasciitis, Achilles tendonitis, to shin splints, to IT band syndrome, all sorts of knee pain, to hip pain even, lower back pain as well. You're just loading too much force on the body if your stride rate's too slow.
We've heard quite often about the 180 strides per minute, 90 per foot. That's much lower, much higher than the 100. So what is your thoughts on the 180?
Oh, I said 100.
100.
I didn't say 100. I meant 170. If I said 100.
Okay, no, we'll edit that. No, we don't edit anything. But
yeah, no, 100 would be like, I don't know, you'd be maybe walking.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear, because I thought, man, I'm really gonna have to slow down because I'm above 100.
you'd be running in slow motion at 100 steps a minute.
Okay, yeah. So
no, I said 170 because it's close to 180.
Yeah,
and 180 is usually optimal. It's usually like what you'd hit during a race. So at race pace, especially in a let's say marathon or under race pace, it's usually hard to get stride rate over 180 when you're going uphill on a technical trail, for example, because mm-hmm. you might be power hiking. But in like a half marathon or a 10K road race, for sure, I think 180 is a good benchmark to hit. And I could see it in my workouts. I upload all my data on Strava.com, all my training. And in faster workouts and racing marathons, like I did the Boston Marathon, I'm really close to averaging about 180, and that's considered to be pretty optimal. But there is individual differences, and so there are people where maybe their sweet spot's closer to 170. And if you're out on an easy pace day and you're running relaxed, usually your stride rate's going to be a little bit slower than if you're going out in a 10K road race, for example. On the flip side, if you're doing a speed workout, you're going to the track and you're doing repeat half miles or 400 meters, you're probably closer to 200 steps a minute. So there's some variation in the stride mm-hmm. rate because it is a little bit dependent on speed. But generally, even on your easy days, if you're at least over 170 and close to 180, you're hitting a pretty good stride rate, and it's ensuring that you're not landing in front of your center of gravity, and that's really the important part.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about a typical week, whether that's a 7-day week or a 10-day week or a 15-day week. How do you calendar out your training sessions, your running pace? And along with that is, how many times before a race do you actually go out and train at race pace?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So it changes a lot depending on what type of race I'm training for, like what my next race is. And I mean, I've mixed it up a lot over the years. Like last year I did 4 road marathons in a span of 10 months, and then also was training for UTMB and Speed Goat, which are mountain races. So a lot different from a road marathon. So that was a tougher mix. And then the year before, I did 9 ultras in a 12-month span, which was too much. It was a lot of different races. But generally, I'd say if I'm training for, let's say, a 50-mile runnable trail, California-style trails, Lake Sonoma, North Face 50, events like that, generally, almost every day that I'm running on a moderate trail, I am actually running about 50-mile race pace. So a lot of times, if you're looking at a low 6-hour 50-mile finish, which I'm consistent at Lake Sonoma and the North Face San Francisco course, it's about 720 per mile pace. And a lot of my easy days are right around that. But I'm mainly running by feel. I'm running by feel. Sometimes I look at my heart rate, but I could usually tell just by my breathing. If I could carry on a conversation, it's easy and relaxed, I could do it. And maybe, you know, on a 10-day cycle, I operate more on 10-day cycles instead of just 7-day weekly cycles. I'll have some sort of pretty long run, maybe with a lot of climbing, course specific. And the long runs are fairly hard. I consider them as quality sessions. And then maybe I'll have another session in there where I'm doing, I call it an uphill tempo run, maybe 20 to 30 minutes up a mountain or up a steep road at about 85%, 88% maximum heart rate or perceived effort. So right around lactate threshold, basically. And then maybe I'll have something shorter in there, maybe not. It depends on how soon my race is coming up and kind of how I feel. But I kind of play things by ear and go by feel a lot of times on the trails. You kind of have to. The splits aren't going to be that consistent.
I think it's interesting how you load everything up on Strava. A lot of competitive athletes that are running for the podium kind of go dark during a period, not letting other people know where they're at or how they're feeling or compare their stats. Can you comment on that, about your thoughts about being fully
public
on that?
Yeah, I have nothing to hide. I like Strava as logging my training. Like, I'm too lazy to do a paper training log now. So if I just remember to wear my GPS every time I go out, then I'll have a log of my run. I'll have my weekly mileage. I could analyze all the metrics, look at my heart rate data and vertical gain and things like that. So it's a really handy training tool. And you know, with our coaching, Sandy and I, we individualize our coaching for our athletes, and it's very catered to the individual needs and strengths and weaknesses of the athlete, as well as the race that they're preparing for. So, you know, what works for me and my training, you know, I'm not worried about someone trying to copy it or something. Like, unless they're a lot like me in terms of physiology, unless they're a lot like me in terms of training for the exact same races coming up, they're probably not going to, there's no secrets to hide, really, I guess is what I'm saying. And hopefully I could always race at a level. You try to race at a level that's above what you're training at. So I learned this in college the hard way. Sometimes you think you're training awesome and you're actually overtraining and you're running these killer workouts. And then all of a sudden comes race day and you come out and you have a horrible race and you're like, gosh, you know, if I couldn't execute on race day, I did all these hard workouts. Well, I'd rather have it be the other way around. People look at Leilog and like, well, you know, Sage is only doing 80 miles a week or only did 10,000 feet of vertical this week. Maybe other people might need more. Maybe other people might need less. But there's no secrets really to hide. And I'm not worried about my competitors looking at my training log, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, so what I hear you saying is go ahead and look at it. Just know that that's not my race day. This is my race prep, and I've got a lot more. I've got more to give than what you're looking at. So let people guess away until race day. That's good.
Hey, Sage, how do you plan your race calendar? And I'll throw in another sub question. What's on your bucket list for the next year?
Okay, so the calendar. A lot of it depends on. Well, timing, like if I think I could pull it off, like in 2014, again, I did 9 ultras and that was a bad idea. So then after that, I'm like, okay, you can't do 9 ultras in 1 year. That's not a good way to say for longevity in the sport. You know, I'm worried about jacking up my endocrine system. I'm worried about an overuse injury. I felt like I was not giving the races the respect they deserved because I was bouncing around every 4 or 5 weeks trying to recover and then train for this next race, and I'd come into it tired. So it depends on the timing, like, you know, where in the calendar year does the race fall. It also depends on what I haven't experienced yet. You know, where's a cool place that I could travel to and run on new trails and meet people from different cultures around the world. That's a really special experience and a luxury and privilege and something that I don't take for granted. So I want to experience that. So the kind of the travel schedule, the international race scene, so to speak, but also just seeing new areas of the U.S. Like I really wanted to do the historic, iconic races like Western States, for example, this year. So that's what motivated me to do the Black Canyon 100K last month, was to get a golden ticket into Western States. It was the only way I was getting in. So I really wanted to do Western States this year, and I appreciate the history. I appreciate the tradition around Western States. It just sounds like a great event. I think it's great competition, which always motivates me as well. And then it'll be hopefully my first 100-mile finish, a new distance. So
yeah.
I like the idea of mixing up distances and different surfaces. Any surface, any distance. That's my motto.
And by your history and record, race record, you have run every distance on every terrain.
Yeah. Well, I got to finish the 100. That's been a big goal.
You mentioned the endocrine system, and I think that's interesting. You don't want to burn that out. We think a lot about soft tissue. We think a lot about the knee or the foot or just the musculoskeletal being the key piece, but it's not. In fact, there's the whole rest of the motor. So let's talk about endocrine system. What do you do to watch it, guard it, and what are you trying to avoid?
Mainly for me, I'm trying to avoid over racing and overtraining. I've been really lucky to be a sponsored ultra runner. I could get enough sleep every night. I don't have to work a full-time job. I've been really fortunate. Whereas I know, most people, you're burning all sorts of stresses in your life. You've got family obligations, you've got work obligations, people aren't getting enough sleep. People are relying on having 5 cups of coffee a day. I don't know, maybe the average American, 5 cups of coffee a day, I'd say. I've worked in offices before, and you just go back to that coffee pot all the time, and you're stressed out. You're sitting down too much. A lot of people in cubicles, like, you definitely get back problems and all sorts of that. But the stress levels build up, and the stress levels cause you to overtrain, even if you're not running 100 miles a week. Maybe you're running 20 or 30 miles a week, but you're only sleeping 6 hours a night on average. Mm-hmm. So you're exhausted, you got family obligations, you've got work obligations, and then you're trying to get in your run. Running's a very stressful thing. It's it's a eustress, but it's also a de-stress. And it causes, besides the skeletal muscular injuries, racing an ultra puts your body in kind of out of whack. You get massively dehydrated, even on a long run, even going out on the weekend for a long run, you can get massively dehydrated. You might not eat enough. You might put yourself in a real state of deprivation, and then your body rebels. And the long-term effects of that could be, it messes with your hormone levels, essentially.
How do you know when you're pushing that envelope where you're thinking, I'm really overusing my endocrine system?
I've usually kept my training in check. I think, like, I ran 150 miles a week once in college, training for 8K and 10K races. I haven't come close to that ever again. So I run generally lower mileage than some of the top guys that you've seen. And, some of the signs of overtraining, usually I start racing poorly. My muscle fibers will get exhausted first. Having trouble falling asleep at night is another one. Having to have my third cup of coffee a day. I love coffee. But if you're having more than 2 cups a day, it's probably you're too tired and you're trying to wake up. It's a tough balance. I've been fortunate so far, but just looking at the schedule on paper and consulting with my girlfriend, who also helps guide my training and coaching, if Sandy says, this doesn't look good on paper, you're crazy, like, this is too much, you can't come back 4 weeks later and do this ultra, then it's probably not a good idea.
Resting heart rate. I think we've talked about that in the past. If you wake up and you're kind of tracking resting heart rate and it starts to become elevated, that's some overtraining too, or can be a
stress. Oh, for sure. Yeah, stress. That's definitely a sign of overtraining.
Yeah. Just want to throw that in there.
But it's only overtraining if you're doing too much from what your body could handle at a certain time.
Mm.
And hopefully that is a moving target. So maybe over time, sleep and work aside, you could train 30 miles a week instead of 25 miles a week because you've built up your skeletal muscular system strength and you've adapted to a higher training load.
Sure. So many variables in the whole scheme. I remember just starting to ramp up miles. And since you started running when you were, in middle school or whatever you had said earlier, and I started later, I remember about mile 12, I was getting some hip pain, fatigue. I mean, hip socket, right where the femur plugs into the pelvis. It's like, dang, my hips are sore out here running this long 12-mile distance, you know? And certainly you do adapt over time. So that came to my mind when you said, you know, hopefully it's a moving target. You get stronger, better. You adapt to the stresses. And so I just recall that. So, Sage, what are you doing different for the 100-mile distance coming up for you? Oh, Western States
is a good question.
Is a big target. Speaking of targets, what's going to change?
Yeah, so I'm basically coming off of doing a lot of road marathons. Like I said last year, I was racing on the roads a lot and running pretty high intensity flat stuff. So now it's just a change of transitioning and getting my mountain legs back, so to speak, getting back on the single track. I took a nice break actually after Black Canyon. And so I took 2 weeks totally off from running. And then now I've been building back. I'm in my second week of training, well, 2.5 weeks about in to training. And it's about reestablishing an aerobic base, just running mostly easy and relaxed. Slowly working my weekly mileage up and getting in a little bit of vertical on the trails. I definitely want to push just an average weekly mileage volume to be a little bit higher, because in the past I feel like I raced too many ultras, I jumped around to too many different events, and I didn't quite have the leg strength that I needed to get through a really long distance ultra. So I do want to get my mileage up. And then I'll also extend my long runs. I think that'll probably be the main variable for the 100-mile, especially on a runnable course like Western States. Mm-hmm. Extend the long run up to over 30 miles and to do some heat training.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Do you have some specific strategies, or are you a great heat runner?
I like the heat better than the cold, that's for sure. At Black Canyon last month, it was probably about 80, and I was coming from like the snow in Boulder.
Yeah, that's like 180. So
it felt really hot. I'm doing Transvolcania, which is the ultramarathon out in the Canary Islands in La Palma in May, and it's pretty hot there usually. So I'm doing that as part of my buildup. So I view that as extra heat training. I basically just wear extra jackets and clothes when I go out and run, and I'm like drenched in sweat. But I'll just wear more layers. That's the biggest thing I do.
Yeah. You have a blog, write some ebooks, you do some YouTube channel stuff. Tell us about how we can see more and hear more of you.
Yeah, so our coaching business that my girlfriend and I run is sagerunning.com, and we actually sell training plans on there. From half marathon up to 100 miles. You can just download them instantly, our training plan. Our long-term coaching, individualized coaching's pretty booked up right now. There's a wait list for that. But you could always download the plans as well as our ebook, The Sage Running Secret, A Guide to Speedy Ultras, which kind of outlines our whole training philosophy, any surface, any distance. And then, I love YouTube. I love the medium of video. My YouTube channel is VO2 Max Productions, but if you just type my name into YouTube search, some videos will probably pop up. But I do training talks there and just post adventure run videos and all sorts of stuff on there. So definitely on YouTube, and then Twitter and Instagram at Sage Canaday, and I have a Sage Canaday Athlete fan page on Facebook as well.
Nice.
So tell us a little bit, just briefly. I one of the things I read about is you. Back after college, you ran in Michigan for the Hanson Distance Project.
Hanson Brooks.
And you actually wrote a book about that. Tell, what is that? That's the first time I've ever even heard of that.
Yeah, so it's a post-collegiate Olympic development group, basically. So you have a lot of groups sponsored by shoe companies, like the Nike Oregon Project is probably the most high-profile one out in Eugene, Oregon, or Portland, Oregon, too. But then there's Zap Fitness, which is another one on the East Coast, as well as Hanson's Brooks, which is based in Michigan. We were sponsored by Brooks Running Shoe Company. And it was basically for runners fresh out of college who wanted to train to try to make the Olympic trials and the Olympics. And they actually succeeded. They started by two brothers who own running stores out there. They own four different running stores around the Detroit area. And they were also coaches. And so they started this program. It has great success. They've had Brian Sell was one of my teammates there. He made the Olympics in Beijing in 2008. And then their most recent star, Desiree Davila, who made the Olympics in 2012 for London, and then also just made the Olympics for 2016 Rio. She was in the Olympic trials marathon. So they've coached several Olympians. But a lot of the guys on the team, we ran in the Olympic trials in 2012. And you work in the shoe store part-time, basically, if you want to, which most of us did. And then you run a lot of times twice a day with all these guys on the team that are pretty fast out of college. So it was a really unique experience and a really fortunate opportunity that I had, because I wasn't the fastest guy coming out of college at all. I was one of the slowest guys on the team. So it was a really unique opportunity to be sponsored fresh out of college as a runner, and kind of a dream come true for me. But in my book, it's kind of immature. I was pretty young back then, but and my writing's not, I'm not a writer. I like making videos a lot more. It's a little rough around the edges. It's just a little self-published memoir, but I kind of talk about the experiences of what I felt at the time and just kind of the struggles. You know, it's not all as glamorous as the magazine articles make it out to be, I guess, is what I wanted to say. But it was a experience I look back fondly on, and it definitely set me up for ultras really well, I think.
Yeah, that's good. Scott, you will undoubtedly, like you always
I'm
do.
I'm linking everything, man.
Link
I've been
all
making
that
linking
stuff.
Notes all podcast
YouTube,
long.
Ebooks, downloading plans to run any distance, any surface. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah.
We'll do all of that.
Well, so one of my takeaways that I've gotten out of, independent of what side of the fence you're on, whether you're on the low carb side, whether you're on the high carb side, or whether you're somewhere in the middle.
One leg on each side?
Yeah, you could be straddling. You could be riding that horse.
Yeah.
The one thing that I take away is you can always eat more vegetables and fruits. I don't think anybody argues that you should not be eating less vegetables and fruits.
And no one advocates eating refined, processed stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the super sweet ingredients, so many ingredients you can't even pronounce half of the words. Nobody says that's a good diet.
Right, right. Yeah. So we appreciate, Sage, for you spending your time and coming on the podcast and giving us just another viewpoint to consider and maybe try.
And not so guilty when I bite into a carbohydrate. It's like, I can't eat this. It's a darn carbohydrate. So thank you, Sage.
I love rice and I love pasta.
For changing my next meal.
Beer is good, too.
And beer. And Avery Beer Brewing Company, right? Is that Avery?
Avery's a sponsor. Yeah, it's a sponsor plug there. Local.
Yeah, I mean, a beer sponsor for an ultra athlete.
And
that's
we should just plug, you know, just because we should. It's the right thing to do. You run for Hoka 1-1. How long have you been with them, Sage?
Oh, that was my third year with Hoka.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so I think that I was hoping you'd say something about Hoka 1-1 on the overuse injury and having a nice cushiony shoe to help you with those overuse injury.
Maybe I'll edit that in.
Avoidance, yeah.
I'll do my Sage impression. Don't worry about saying anything.
No, the good thing about Hoka is they sponsor road marathon runners, but they also sponsor a lot of ultra runners. So they have so many different types of shoes for any surface, any distance. And different models depending on how much you pronate or supinate. So it's all about finding your own fit and your favorite model of shoe. And Hoka has a really good variety and is always coming out with new innovative designs. So that's a big positive for me.
Which shoe do you lace up when you're headed up the Flatirons for a daily run?
I don't run. The Speed Goat right now.
The Speed
Goat?
It's
the best. I think it's the best all-around traction. It has a Vibram outsole. And then it's still pretty light, and it's still very responsive and cushioned for bombing the descents on the rocks. Because we do have some technical trails out there. It's kind of rocky and covered in ice and snow right now, a little bit.
They're very technical. I've been up there.
Hoka has evolved. You know, initially they were just very, very thick shoes, and now you take a look at them. They're getting a different look to them. They look good.
Yeah, we got some 7-ounce ones coming out. Wow. The Tracer and the Clayton, they're out now actually at some places. So
okay,
super light.
Well, best of luck to you and your training. I'm very anxious to watch some of the races coming up to States and then you at States. That'll be fun.
Yeah,
I'm going to
we'll
be rooting for you.
We'll
absolutely
be out there cheering for you at States.
Oh, awesome! Well, that'd be great to hear. You have any events coming up? You guys are running in?
Yeah.
Don has some. He's racing this weekend.
Yeah, but the Ultra Marin Challenge. I'm going to get out there and.
Nice.
Yeah, that I just love the headlands out there. You know, there may be.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's so nice. I mean, you go around a corner and you get surprised by the coastline and another corner, and all of a sudden Sausalito opens up to you, and then you're running through a grove of eucalyptus trees, and oh man, it's the best.
And Don has his best podium finish out there.
There's a little bridge out there too, called the Golden Gate. It's got quite a nice set of views.
And I will say that Don is taking it to the next level. I have to brag about Don.
What level?
He's hasn't quite signed the dotted line, but he will. He's going to do the Tahoe 200 mile race this year.
Candace Burt has a wrist hold on me right now. Yeah. It's halfway behind my back. We'll see what happens with that.
Oh, that'll be epic.
If I sign up, it'll be epic. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. Sage Candidate, thank you so much, and go out and run.
Mas.
Petzl headlamps. Not a headlamp.
They're a torch, Don.
You know, if you put a lamp on your head and you ran around, people would start to talk.
But if you have a torch, they're just going to run behind you.
That's right, because you'll lead the way.
You're going to be leading the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Petzl does. They lead the way in head torches.
Reactive lighting, rechargeable, the whole thing. And the strap that goes on the head, so easy to adjust. There were times...
Even Don can do it.
There were times, Scott, I'm going to have to turn my man card in and say, Scott, could you please tighten this up for me? Because I just don't have that skill set. But the new type that Petzl has,
yeah,
super easy and effective.
You know, I typically go to the Tika RXP. Because it's a lighter one, it's not as heavy as the Now. But I pulled out the Now the other day. That sure is a nice head torch.
It's not that heavy, Scott.
It's not, and it's freaking bright.
It's bright.
And its battery lasts a little bit longer than that Tika RXP.
If you've ever run at night and you've run through the day and into the night, you'd know how much work it is to try to concentrate. And when you have enough light on the trail, it's a lot easier.
I was having a conversation with a fellow friend of mine. He's not a fellow friend. He's just a friend.
What is? Let me Google fellow friend. What is a fellow friend?
But he was in the market for a headlamp. And a lamp
for his head, Scott?
I think he went to REI and he saw some real expensive ones. And he said, you know what? I'm just going to get this $25 headlamp.
Big mistake.
And then I showed him what a Petzl Now is. And he said, really, is it worth that much more? And I go, every single penny. You're going to spend more money on batteries for that stinking little headlamp.
You're right.
Over the course of the life of that headlamp. Why not invest in a Petzl Now or a Petzl Tika RXP? It's going to pay. The ROI on it is crazy.
Some business talk. You know, you spend money on shoes. You spend money on a lot of things. In fact, you spend a lot of money just driving up to the trailhead. Make sure you put yourself in the right gear. And do you know what it costs for a fractured wrist or a twisted ankle or a busted tooth?
A lot.
That's what happens when you can't see what you're doing.
Yep. And it scares off the bears. Go to Petzl.com.
Ultra Running Magazine, probably my favorite printed journal.
It is awesome, and I smile every time I go to the mailbox and pull it out because it is it is probably the only magazine that I subscribe to that I read it cover to cover. It's that good.
I don't know what kind of power that Carl and Erica have over there with the ultra running community, but they have the coolest and best contributing authors anywhere.
It's because they are members and leaders of the ultra running mafia.
There's a mafia?
They threaten and they extort to get the very best writers to write for their magazine.
Well,
and it's always improving. There's all sorts of new writers that are coming on board. Anne Trason is on monthly now where you can ask her questions.
Ask Anne, yeah.
You know, Corey Reese, we've talked about him, and he, I'll tell you what, he's a fun guy to read.
So 2016, get yourself a year subscription for only $29.95.
Go to our partners page. There's a link there. You can link over, and you will get your discount, and you can begin a life of better performance.
Go to the partners page, link over, and bam, you're there.